You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
I'm Catherine Nichols, and this is Lit Century, a podcast where we talk about one book for each year of the 20th century. This week our year is 1984, and I'm going to be talking about the video game Tetris with game designer Tracy Ray Bolling. They have a game out right now on itch.io called The Fight, and they're working on a new game called The Color of the Moon. They also have a podcast called Gift Horse with Mike McGuinness, who was on our Strangers on a Train episode. I assume that the game Tetris doesn't need a lot of summary for listeners. It's the one where different shaped blocks float down a screen and you have to make them line up in rows, which disappear once they're complete. That's all there is to the game, but there's a lot more that we wanted to say about it. Here's our conversation. Tracy, welcome to the podcast. It was such a treat to be on your podcast on Gift Horse before. I'm really happy that you're here on Lit Century. And I also really loved your idea of doing Tetris as a topic. It is not a book. Obviously, it's not the first time that Lit Century has done something that is not a book. But it seemed like such a unique cultural object that in some ways is a lot like a lot of things that came before, but is like once you know everything that comes after Tetris, it's a lot more like things that come later than it is like anything that comes before.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it played a big role in ushering video games into sort of the public consciousness as something that a lot of people would play and share an experience with. Not that there weren't any games like that. Like this is after Pong, this is after Frogger and things like that, but I think it definitely made more people aware of games as a shared experience that they could engage with others in.
Yeah, in a way, it seems more alone also, because it's not something you play in an arcade. I mean, you could technically play Tetris in an arcade, but I think that the classic idea of what you're doing when you're playing Tetris is you're sitting in front of your computer alone, sort of like the bathed in blue light, like just losing hours of time, right?
Yes.
And I definitely know that there's that idea that you have like a, you know, pocket full of quarters and you just sort of eat through them playing Pac-Man or whatever. But mm-hmm. even so, that's not quite the same as just how much Tetris has no beginning and no end. And it can just kind of eat your life at any amount of time you could spend playing Tetris. And it's always sort of the same experience. And it is always incredibly satisfying.
Yeah, it's unique in that way. I think you're right. I don't know this for a fact. I'm not like super well-versed in games journalism, but I think that there is definitely a tendency right around the emergence of Pac-Man to start talking about video games as these incredibly addictive things that sort of hijack your brain without you knowing it. And I think Tetris was one of the first to be referred to in that way as almost sort of this virus that once you saw someone playing Tetris, you too would succumb to the Tetris impulse.
And that's pretty much like the documentaries we were both watching about the, it's amazing how much it seemed like a virus, how it was just passed from like computer to computer in the laboratories around the developer that first developed it. And it just took over everyone's, like that at first the psychologist tried to get people to stop, like he demanded that everyone in his laboratory erase it from their computers. And it came back in, like they couldn't stop people from playing Tetris. And then he was like, all right, fine, we'll study addiction. And I think that like when, like before the internet became what it is, the idea of being the kind of person who looks things up in the dictionary, being the kind of person who reads the encyclopedia was like an identity or a personality. And I think there was a moment in early internet where it was like being the kind of person who looks things up in Wikipedia still seemed kind of like an identity. But really that way that you can just sit in front of Tetris or the internet, Wikipedia, or, you know, TV tropes or whatever, fan fiction archive, like anything, so many ways on the internet that you can just lose 6 hours of your life without even being aware of the time passing.
And you're often, I, you know, stop me if this is going too far, but it feels like you're often telling yourself a story about what you're accomplishing by doing that.
Yeah.
You know, that you're learning something, you're achieving something by going down this rabbit hole, or by playing too many rounds of Tetris. There's a, at least
in a all the kids in that Quiverful family with the block. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this illusion that you're learning something, which, I mean, I think you are in a way. I think that Tetris is a good example of a game that teaches you how to play it and doesn't have to do a lot of tutorializing to get you there, that your brain does sort of figure out good strategies as you play more and more of it. And that itself is a pretty addictive feeling, yeah, that you're figuring something out and you're doing it on your own.
Yeah. It, one of the things from the past that it seems kind of like is chess in that way, that the way that people talk about chess, like it's something bigger than just a game. It's not like dominoes or checkers or something like that. It's like, it's something people would do science about. And I think that there's a big desire to do science about Tetris also. Like, you know, the studies about how it helps, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and it, like the Tetris effect, where your brain keeps on giving you ways that these blocks could interlock even after you've stopped playing, because your brain is like, I know what you want. You want more of
something. You want to continue stacking. Have you ever experienced that?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Cool. I mean, it freaked me out the first time I experienced it. Like, I had a Tetris dream, and I was very into Tetris. I think it was my final year of grad school, or maybe the first year I was out. I was playing a lot of Tetris before bed, and I eventually had to like almost set a timer on myself to say, you cannot play more than this amount of Tetris or you will not be able to sleep because you will dream of Tetris. And it was a real problem for a while.
Yeah, I was thinking about things that it's like I guess it was the year after I graduated from college, I did a lot of crossword puzzles, and I was like, crossword puzzles feel like writing, but they're actually not writing, but they feel like they are because you're kind of solving language problems and mm-hmm. you're like doing a very moderate amount of research and, you know, that kind of thing. And it feels like you're doing something that you're not actually doing. And in one of those documentaries, there was actually I think it was Hank Rogers, the one who like kind of brought it out of He brought out of Hungary or out of Russia? Which step was Hank Rogers?
He was pretty involved in both. He kind of got it out of Hungary, but he also was the one to ultimately kind of take the prize away from Russia to get their the full rights to distribute it on handheld consoles.
Yeah. Okay. That I remember that. There were so many details of the whole like licensing story. And you said you took notes. I took notes for a while. Then I was like, I don't know, guys.
Oh no. And I definitely didn't catch all the various transitions, but yeah, I found it kind of fascinating the way it changed hands without.
It changed hands so many times. And some of the times that it changed hands seemed like they were doing shady business because they thought that the whole Cold War Iron Curtain thing allowed them to do stuff that they would not consider ethical if they were talking about other Americans.
Yes.
You know,
no, I think absolutely so. I think, you know, there was a lot of sort of global commerce game playing there, and the different people who were so involved in trying to get the rights to Tetris, I think did think they could play pretty fast and loose or rely on different strategies, right? Like there were some who had good connections with the Kremlin and they could maybe rely on that or thought they could. And there were some who were great salesmen in sort of a traditional, well, not a, in like a post-World War II sort of way of.
Yeah.
High consumerism and getting people to imagine this world of possibility, you know, like the science of marketing was what they were good at, and they thought that would conquer all. It's just interesting how many different strategies there were.
One of the things in there is that the guy who actually invents it. Sorry, I'm going to just look up his name to make sure I'm getting it right. Yes.
I was going to ask you how to pronounce it.
Alexei Pajitnov. So he invented it based on his being bored at his programming job and remembering how it's really easy to take pentominoes, you know, like tile puzzle, out of the box, really hard to put them back in. And so he did like this really simple game that was just putting the pentominoes into a box but then once you do it, you're done. And so he had this idea of having them falling. So you have to sort of continually keep putting them in and then deleting the rows. I mean, what everyone knows, you know, except that they had five pieces each and then he reduced it down to four pieces each. Right. I'm not saying this like you don't know it, Tracy.
No. I think
each one of
those is a game design decision, and it's super important to the effect. So
yeah, no, I felt like that description of what his thinking was in each of those, like as he developed each of those ideas, I thought that was really interesting. I thought it made sense that this would like each step seemed like logically quite close to what came before, but the result is something that really isn't logically close to anything that we had before, you know?
I think a lot of them created that impetus to keep playing and keep playing and keep playing, right? Like you said, you're with the original form of the game, you fill up a box with a set number of pieces. And if you figure it out, you're done. And if you don't figure it out, then you're frustrated falling and the lines disappear. Then you have to keep making those decisions over and over again.
Yeah. The fact that the lines disappear, so you never make progress really. He names it based on the Greek word tetra and the tennis, the word tennis. So that's where Tetris comes from. And I was thinking that both the pentominoes that the tetrominoes are based on, like there's an implicit end to the activity. And then in tennis, you just get physically tired.
Right.
And
the limits are your limits.
Yeah. That there's pretty much no activity that I can think of that predates Tetris that's that open-ended.
Right. You did, yeah. Like, I think in theory, most of the games at that time would just, or puzzle type games, would just keep feeding you levels, and they would escalate one small piece of the gameplay, right? Like, they, your ships get faster. There are more bullets. There are more enemies. You have less time. You know, they just keep tweaking the parameters. And I think, if I remember right, later versions of Tetris, I don't know that it was part of the original to escalate the speed with which the pieces fell. That's a common modification now. But like you said, it's just sort of like, when do you get tired of it?
Exactly. Like that feeling of bottomlessness. I think we have a lot of things now. Candy Crush never gets more difficult. It's always just basically the same thing. You're pretty much going to have the same experience. Yeah, so one of the things that Hank Rogers said, and this seemed extremely 20th century to me, he said that Tetris is a better game than like Space Invaders or whatever more arcade style games that had existed before, because everyone thought that Americans just wanted violence. They wanted to be able to shoot things, and that was what made a game appealing. But Tetris is about building, and that's sort of more archetypal human like satisfaction. And I was thinking archetypes, my old enemy. I was like, extremely 20th century move of saying something is serious because it was an archetype.
Yes. We love to build.
Yeah, that's like, well, sort of, but you could also say it's very much unlike building, because every time you build something, it gets zapped away.
Right. It's a staving off of chaos as much as it is, you know, like I do tend to think of it. I don't know that I would say it's archetypal, but I do think that there is at least a pretty typical, like a general brain urge to order things.
Yeah. I mean, you could say that there's a general brain urge toward order, but there's also a general brain urge toward messing stuff up. You know, like you could say that either Space Invaders or Tetris is satisfying because in one of them you create order and another you zap order out of, you know, you like zap the little aliens till they stop having a formation, whatever.
I think that same quote, I had the thought, because that quote sort of launched into this discussion of Tetris as this negative impulse, like you're trying to stave off destruction, you're trying to avoid the blocks climbing up toward the top, and you're meanwhile like cursing your mistakes because your mistakes that caused this problem are left as holes and gaps that you know didn't fill correctly, so you have to see your mistakes. And
it's true, they stay visible. Yeah, and like that one, like if there's like one of the tall guys,
one of
the long boys, you didn't.
There is some abysmal stock footage that they use. Like, I'm like, this is not a person playing Tetris. This is a person who left Tetris on for 20 minutes while they recorded footage. No player would do this. No player would put a long boy there.
I know they have other names.
But I do think that there's... Yeah, they really emphasized that it's a game that succeeds because it makes you unsatisfied, but I think that it keeps you in this constant balance almost between the two states, because as much as you might want to try to order things correctly, the only way you can get a chance to fix your mistakes is if you clear something. If you clear enough to sort of reopen your mistakes.
Yeah.
And there's a real impulse to do that. And so, yeah, I kind of balked against it being called a negative impulse, I think.
Yeah. I think that it just, in some ways, it was so new that anything could be like that. Even in a world that already had things like pinball and Space Invaders and other arcade games, I just think they didn't even know what they were looking at. They didn't have any framework to really describe it. And that trance-like kind of meditative state that you fall into playing Tetris, such that you would actually fully dream about it, I don't know that there was ever an easy way to like achieve that before. You know, you think about all of the things that hypnotists or religious people do to achieve various states of kind of calm alertness or attention that is also disconnected. And then yeah. Tetris is just like, here, it's easy, it's fun.
Yeah, it immediately grabs your focus. And certainly I found it more powerful as a way to grab my own focus as opposed to meditation or any other interventions. So yeah, it's a mysterious power.
It is. And then I think that those studies saying that it helps PTSD and that all of the other equivalent things that would help PTSD, where basically the idea is that you think about the traumatic memory, but you aren't as connected to the emotion of it because you're also playing Tetris, which can pull away enough of your focus and your sensory apparatus that you aren't kind of reliving it, and that can separate your emotions from something that is obviously very emotionally powerful and terrifying, you know. Sorry, we were just talking about Tracy getting scared while we're recording the podcast. So provide a few thrills and chills for her.
No, I'm safe. I'm safe.
You're safe because you have your game. Yeah. Sorry. I just think that all the other things where they're like, well, there's, you know, rapid eye movement. It's similar to like rapid eye movement where you're distracted by the motion of your eyes. And I'm thinking, you're supposed to be distracted by the motion of your eyes. I don't know. Seems a lot less distracting. That seems like it's a much bigger force of will to force yourself to be distracted by the motion of your eyes than a game of Tetris. It's not that I think that people actually are in a religious state when they are playing Tetris, but, or, you know, any of the many similar games that there are now. It's more like, what does it mean to be able to have that state become easy and fun and even a vice rather than a virtue that is sort of hard won?
You know? Right. Yeah. And there's certainly an impetus because these are video games to say that this is sort of a lesser way of reaching that state or an under, you know, this is not how that can be achieved.
You're going to go on the record with video games are lesser as a video game designer. It's bold.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like there's that temptation there that I think that, I'm trying to think of a similar sort of phenomenon. I don't know. This isn't a very good one, but, you know, maybe something like saying, comics are not a good way of getting narrative content or something.
Oh, totally. I think that's a great analogy because I think that there's that feeling that they're new and they're cheap and therefore they must be bad. And that some of them are bad, but some of everything is bad.
And I feel like I'm about to skydive from 30,000 feet here, but the way you're talking about Tetris sort of makes me think of the original novels and sort of how they were perceived, just sort of the way that the novel was a originally this lower class way to consume, or maybe not lower class, but lower intensity way to gain knowledge or to exercise your brain, and to read, you know, like this wasn't
so pleasurable.
Fodder.
Like it was seen as like so pleasurable. There had to be something wrong with it.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yeah. That's the feeling that I think I think carried really, across those two.
Yeah. I think it's a really good analogy. I think that one thing that Tetris does that has to do with how it was invented by this one guy who was sort of alone at work wanting something that would become interesting, that I think something like Candy Crush and other modern Tetris type spin-offs have changed, is if you're playing Candy Crush, you can put it down at any time for any amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
With Tetris, you really can't stop playing Tetris. Like if someone interrupts you while you're playing, you have to fully quit the game. Or, you know, maybe you could pause the game, but it's kind of not, like even if there's a pause function, it's not the same as the kind of game where you can just stop at any point for any amount of time. And I think mm-hmm. that the cliche now is that people who play casual games like Candy Crush on their, it's like a mom thing to do.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Mobile games in particular are pretty looked down on.
Yeah.
Even in the larger gaming community, they're like this subset of games or the sub tier.
Yeah. So that's why I found it so interesting that it's like, first of all, everyone involved in the propagation of Tetris around the world is a man. And they're all just like, oh my goodness, we have to find a way to harness this possibly sinister Russian plot to make sure we never get work done again. And, but at the same time, like all the marketing has to do with its like spooky Russian-ness.
Yes, yes. That was fascinating to me because I didn't realize that the original marketing did, like that would have been, if you had just asked me how they would market it, I would have thought they wanted to stay, would want to stay as far away from Russian iconography as possible. And yeah. Instead it was this moment of transition, I think, of like, oh no, Russia is mysterious and forbidden and, you know, we want to consume it now.
Since I spent a lot of time researching the Ballet Russe, the idea that Russia is both mysterious and forbidden and possibly sort of magical. Definitely.
Right.
It predates the Cold War, but obviously the Cold War, they're very into it. And it is interesting that the packaging in the English version of Tetris was like it emphasized the Russian element a lot less, and it also sold less well than the US version. But yeah, I just think that the place in society for casual games, like the way that they're looked down on now, has to do with the fact that it's moms that play them and that moms need to be interrupted all the time and can't really achieve a flow state like Tetris.
Yeah, yeah. So
I think that that's one reason that the Tetris, I really don't think it is played that much anymore.
Right. No, you're right. You ask yourself who had or maybe still has 4 hours to just lose to Tetris.
And yeah.
It's and not if, somebody with, you know, a family.
It's not. It's also like, if you do have that time, is Tetris the thing you would spend it on?
Right.
And it's like, well, no, because you'd probably, I don't know, listen to like 4 episodes of a podcast or
mm-hmm.
Like read Wikipedia or something like that. I mean, there's so many other things that have that same quality now.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. And I think they present a little more illusion of, I don't know, agency. Maybe, you know, that Tetris feels like this thing that you can't stop yourself from doing, but, you know, watching a bunch of YouTubes about a particular era of music or watching a bunch of YouTubes about a guy playing a synthesizer, which I have sometimes done.
On the public record, we're going to admit to the guy with synthesizer YouTube.
Huh? Yes. I tell myself I'm learning something, right? Oh, I'm going to really absorb this, and this is going to, you know, help me in my own pursuits of making music. But I don't study it. I don't take notes. I don't practice what I've learned. I just consume it. And ultimately that's just pleasure too. It has a bit more veneer, I think, of learning.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you could say all the same things about reading a book about synthesizers, but I don't think people's relationship to books has ever been, you know, what a relationship to the internet could be in terms of ability to just waste time on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
People can go into a library and spend the day pleasurably, but I also don't think that it's the same kind of like mental squalor available to you.
Right.
But like at this point, even if you were to just watch TV and eat snacks all day, that would seem like an amazing degree of long-term focus.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you just watched Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which I think is the kind of thing people probably did before there was much internet, you know?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I was thinking about, you know, more of a binging sort of.
But do people just binge watch TV, or do they binge watch TV while they're also on Twitter?
Exactly.
Through Instagram.
Right.
Yeah.
Rather than making a habit of sitting down in front of the TV and I'm going to watch what comes on. The unpredictability of that as much as anything, I think, creates the illusion that you're engaged.
Yeah, but I wonder, because I think that watching a lot of TV in a dissolute way was something that people thought of as like mental squalor, you know?
Yes.
Did hold that part of in society where it was like, what did you do this weekend? Oh, I just closed the curtains and watched TV would be similar to like if you just spent all day on the internet. So it's mm-hmm. not maybe that there wasn't anything. I'm sure people lost a lot of time playing pool or billiards. Yes,
that's probably true. But it's true. You don't feel like you don't hear that referred to, that somebody threw their life away on billiards.
Not anymore.
Maybe, yeah, I was going to say, maybe not anymore.
I think gambling, if there's gambling involved for money, I think that people can probably just keep on going for a lot longer than they would have if it was something without money on the line.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's that feeling of like making progress sort of, even though you know you're not.
Yes. Yeah, you're sort of making a bet with yourself about how long you'll keep doing the activity. Which again feels a little like engagement, I would have to imagine, from the people who would justify it as, you know, no, I actually am doing something very productive here. I am losing money.
Well, but it's also social. And you probably mm-hmm. do it when you're drunk, too, which is like Tetris is neither social nor does it involve like getting drunk. Nobody's like, I had a couple of beers and finally had the quality time with Tetris that I had been looking forward to all week.
I set aside 4 hours to do a fixed amount of Tetris.
Exactly. It's like, it's a game that could only exist when people have computers and they have boring desk jobs of the Dilbert variety.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a certain amount of privacy and lack of interruption. It's like,
I think that's, sorry.
Oh, just, it's like those exact social conditions and no others.
Yeah, because at first I was thinking, I wonder how much I think of Tetris as a solo game, because all my experiences with it have been social to some extent. There's been a bit of a competitive element to it. Like maybe I would play it with my husband or with a couple of friends, or very interesting thing. If you ever want to truly see what it might look like to conquer Tetris, if Tetris could be conquered, watch somebody speed run it.
Oh, it's, wow.
Yeah, it feels like they're defeating Tetris. It should be impossible.
I don't know if that would even be satisfying. Like, poor Tetris.
Yeah, I know. It does. It feels kind of sad. I mean, it's kind of, chess is in a similar state, right? Like the people who are at the very top of the game of chess are so, they know the ins and outs of it so well, and they can predict the outcome so well that all that's left is the scant possibility that they'll mess up.
Yeah.
And so that's the same with Tetris. It's just like, well, if somebody just kind of has a bad day, then Tetris is not destroyed.
Well, I read that on the Wikipedia page that that in theory you could play it forever, but unless you get a series of the S, like Z shape pieces, that can't be sort of put together correctly. That if you got a whole bunch of those in a row, which would mathematically happen at some point if they're truly random, then it could be unwinnable at some point. Impossible to clear the layers, and so they programmed it to make sure that wouldn't happen, so that the newer versions are actually theoretically infinitely playable. So, like you said, it would only come down to human error. It's the only way. And as ordinary mortals, we can capture that thrill by playing tic tac toe.
Yeah, the worst game in history.
I am going to tell Tic-Tac-Toe that you said that at the next game designer conference.
It's actually, I think it's widely acknowledged. It's one of the first examples of, in a lot of game design textbooks, they'll sort of pose to you, okay, your first assignment, fix Tic-Tac-Toe.
Oh, wow.
Because it's just missing, there's a lot you could do to improve it just by tweaking very small elements, like the number of squares or the number of players, or
so if you were to tweak the number of squares, do you still have it be three in a row? Like if it were four by four,
I don't think you would. I think you would. You know, like I should know this a little bit more, but this kind of to me falls a little bit more in the realm of like tabletop board game design, but like certain shapes and numbers of shapes that create effective play. Like that's why a lot of games involve hexagons and hexagon shaped playing mats.
Oh, is because,
yeah, the six sides create a satisfying array of possibilities where cubes do not always.
that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
So yeah, there's some theory around that. Maybe you would make kind of a diamond of the tic-tac-toe board. There are a lot of things you could do. But
cool. Wow, I'm glad you told me that. I didn't know that. So do you want to talk about where game design is now in things? Like, do you know stuff about where I'll erase this, by the way, if you don't have something to say, but what Tetris style games are like now?
No, this is a really good question. I will say a couple things in relationship to this. One, Alexei Butchinov, The creator of Tetris has not really had any more slam dunk puzzle games. I think that he has created a few more, but they have not taken off in the same way. And I think that there was maybe kind of a limit to the deceptive simplicity of his style of game, the style of game that really kept him going with developing Tetris, because there's this great line where he says there was a moment where he felt the game breathe.
Yeah.
You know, and I like to think that's sort of where he figured out how to twist the concept of the tabletop game into something that was interactive, that did start to feel more interactive and something that the player could control and feel a lot of agency in. And I'm not sure the player stayed with him on that. I think, like you said, everyone was exposed to Tetris. Everybody loved Tetris, and then everybody kind of got tired of Tetris.
The part of our lives where it made sense to play changed.
Yes.
Like, I don't know that people are tired of Tetris exactly. It's just
because you can still go back to it, and
you go back to it, it's still really fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think there is a reason Tetris did so well on a handheld console, that it was something that was a very good way to while away time in a way that other games had not been. And it really fit the portable form factor. But yeah, I think puzzle games now tend to have a lot more options in terms of things the player can do. It's been kind of my experience. So there's not the possibility space for just like placing blocks in a container and being able to rotate them and move them left and right. Like, that possibility space has been really thoroughly explored, I think. Yeah. So now a lot of the puzzle games are playing more with like, okay, what if you have like items that can blow up certain parts of the puzzle, and that sort of resets your progress in a certain way? What if you have items that glue pieces of the puzzle together? And they sort of play with instability in that way, and unpredictability.
Yeah. And you can see why it's both interesting, but it also makes them more like arcade games, where it's like, well, what if you have this different kind of gun on your ship?
And
what
exactly? Yes. It feels very much like, you know, it becomes almost more of a collection at that point.
Yeah.
Like a shiny object, you know, my special items.
Yes. That's interesting. And it also means there's more stuff you have to learn. There's more buy-in.
Yes.
You can't just pick it up and immediately know exactly how everything works.
And that makes it work very well with sort of the mobile games format too. If you can easily have additional downloadable content where you can easily introduce a new item or a new mechanic, then
in-app purchases.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's almost a detriment to design a game like Tetris that is sort of self-contained, that cannot be augmented meaningfully.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably someone somewhere cares if you can like get different skins for your Tetris blocks, but I don't think I think that might be a rare person.
That's our episode on Tetris. Thank you to Tracy Ray Bowling and to Adam Baer for our music, and to everyone at Literary Hub for hosting us. Thank you also to everyone who has rated and reviewed us on Apple Podcasts. We also love hearing from you through Twitter, LitCenturyPod, or on Gmail at litcenturypodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening, and goodbye till next week.